Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. This is the No Holds Barred Intra-Progressive What the Hell Should We Be Doing About Libya edition with Heather Hurlburt from the National Security Network.
And Michael Cohen from American Security Project. And actually, this is not just inter-progressive, it's actually inter-blog, because we are both bloggers, or intra-blog, bloggers at Democracy Arsenal.
Okay, well, it's even better than that, of course, as you know, because Michael's actually on my board at the National Security Network. So if this gets too heated, viewers can expect to see me out on the street with a tin cup later today.
Exactly.
So, Michael, I think something that you and I, and if you want to go and see sort of long prehistories of some of the debate we're about to have, please go check us out at Democracy Arsenal. But Michael, one thing that I think you and I agree on is that it's important to conduct this debate from a sort of core interests, values, first principles, not just, oh, let's do something because we feel bad.
Sure. I mean, that to me is kind of the issue a little bit, is that there's, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that we need to intervene to stop civilian casualties and to stop atrocities. But it's troubling to me that there's no clear national security interest in what we're doing. And, you know, without that kind of clear national security framework, it seems like kind of going in willy-nilly, any real thought process to, you know, what the strategy is and what the end game is supposed to be.
Okay, so let's stop there, because I think we've actually just hit sort of a core point that doesn't get drawn out enough, that there's a core, there's a key divide, there's several kind of key fault lines in people's thinking, and one of them is this question of whether you can have a core national interest or a core security interest that's about humanitarian values. And I believe you can, and there's a great body of people who believe you can't.
I think you can, but it has to be very heavily caveated. You know, I mean, I don't think that the U.S. has a national security interest intervening on its own in Libya. And one of the reasons I have, you know, my general hesitation about using military force, I have some pause, is that the international community has signed off on this, literally. And so it makes me feel a little more comfortable with it that, you know, the Europeans are taking the lead, which is sort of amazing but fantastic, I guess, that the Arab League is taking the lead or indicating that they're interested in taking the lead, which is also amazing and fantastic. So from that perspective, I sort of see it as a potentially, that's the good part about this. You know, to me, the fact that you've got an international security sort of structure or system in place of countries actually willing to act in this kind of a situation and respond to what is a clear humanitarian crisis is a very positive thing. And even more positive, the U.S. is not expected to take the military lead here. You know, the notion that we can share the responsibility for these kind of situations is a really incredible development, actually, and something that I think very unusual thing that's happened in the last 8 years. And the U.S. relations with the U.N. and the rest of the world when it comes to using military force.
Well, I mean, this to me actually is perhaps the biggest achievement. I mean, I'm very conscious that as we're taping this, on the one hand, Gaddafi's foreign minister has announced a ceasefire. On the other hand, there's clearly still fighting going on the ground. So we, as we're taping this, we just have no idea where this is going on the ground. But I do think one thing is that it's worth pulling back and saying, after an eight-year period in which the notion that anybody could ever non-cynically go to the UN Security Council and say we'd actually like a UN resolution under Chapter 7 to stop the killing of civilians, the idea that any non-NATO government could actually do that with a straight face was so denigrated and seemed so far, that just what this says about the resuscitation of the UN system. And you know, and I think, you know, in the coming weeks and months, we'll understand more about why the Arab League did what it did. And some of that, frankly, is going to have sort of very classical national security interests and not be about sort of high-flying humanitarian motives. And it's important, it's important not to be kind of blind about that. But it is also the case that the both what the Arab peoples have done on the street to change their societies and pressure their governments in the last 2 months, and what Obama has done in the last 2 years in terms of returning the idea that you could actually do stuff of value with the U.S. at the U.N., got us to the point where you could go to the UN and ask for a resolution. And the other thing, just sort of on the international systems point, that is so extraordinary about what's happened is everyone's talking about the no-fly zone. And, you know, frankly, this is another thing about this whole debate that has just been really stupid, is people just talk about the shiny thing and not about
the
other stuff. But you have, you know, the U.S. and the Europeans and Arab nations and African nations together saying, okay, we're going to refer to these people to the International Criminal Court. We're going to have a strong unified sanctions regime. We're going to have enforcement of sanctions. All the tools that people have been trying to put in place in the international system since Bosnia and Rwanda, you have sort of being adopted pretty smoothly without a lot of contention. And that that's just an amazing thing. And a point that I make is it's unclear. It's tragically unclear how much this is going to help people in Benghazi. And that's, you know, I was peripherally I was in government and peripherally involved with both Bosnia and Kosovo. And every one of these that has ever happened, the international community is late, the U.S. is late, the response is dithering, the goals are unclear, the end state is unclear. We just, as a species, we're not set up to do this, we're set up to frustrate this. But there will, just as Bosnia and Kosovo, but then there was Macedonia, which was a huge success, Rwanda, which was a stain on the face of humanity, but then Burundi. This will help other people someplace else at some time in the future, and I think that's important to say.
Well, and 2 points here. I mean, I really agree with you about the international system, as far as whatever that amorphous phrase means, that this is a real victory for that system, in the sense that we are basically going to a national organization, namely the UN, and creating a response, a security response to what is a serious crisis. And that is something that, as you said, we haven't really seen too often. And in a sense, it's a victory, I think, for the UN. It's a victory for the notion that you have this sort of international system that can respond to such a crisis. My problem is a little bit like, okay, so what's next?
Yeah.
Is the UN and EU and or whatever willing coalition the willing of them?
I was going to say one of the things this is actually it's another sort of blade to the gut for the EU because of the fact that the
yeah absolutely
the French
that's exactly
went
right
way and the Germans went the other way.
Well, I'm sure that the Germans were thrilled with that conversation for his feeling on that, but wasn't a conversation. But I mean, you know, are these countries just going to step in and help rebuild Libya? Are they going to, you know, support whatever if a new government comes into power?
Yeah, well, what is there going to be to rebuild, and who's the government going to be, and how are they going to reunify the country? And this is where I agree with you, and I'm very concerned. I hope that the governments that are taking the lead have a better plan about this than the Brits had when they deposited their little special forces commandos on the beach a couple weeks back. I'm very concerned about that, and I think it's totally fair to mention that at every juncture.
I mean, I think that's my concern, is that we've gone into this without any kind of debate. You know, there's been no congressional debate about this, no congressional authorization for sure. I mean, Obama hasn't even spoken about this publicly. I think he's leaving the country today. I mean, I can't believe actually he's going to go, but it's sort of amazing. You've got a situation in which
The U.S. isn't. I mean, U.S. warplanes aren't bombing anything. This is the paradigmatic scenario of where someone else is taking the lead, and Obama is going.
Do we know that for sure, though? Do we know that for sure?
Look, we don't know anything for sure at this point, and they're clearly hoping that they don't have to do anything. There's an aircraft carrier that's come into position, but they're not going to be flying the sorties off of carriers, is my understanding. So I think my understanding is that it's going to be AWACS from the U.S., but that's not anything I've seen anywhere in print. Yeah. So I do think, you know, it's interesting. You point up that we now have sort of the ability to do the formal UN mechanism a lot better than anybody has the ability to sit down and figure out exactly what is the most efficacious thing to do. Although I mean, there has been quite a lot of congressional debate on the subject, and you have this kind of crazy place where you have Kerry and McCain on one side and Lugar on the other.
Lugar. Yeah, but there has been, but there's been no congressional opposition to use the force. And we don't actually, we don't even know right now if the U.S. is going to use the force in Libya. We don't know that. I mean, it's very possible that the U.S. plans to bomb in Libya.
I really don't think so.
My sense of reading some of the press coverage suggests that that the U.S. assets are sort of being mobilized in place. I mean, certainly the Journal of the Times article suggested as much. I mean, but I hope you're right, and I assume that you're right. I can't believe that the U.S. military assets are in the fight, but I think it's kind of crazy that we don't know for sure. And I think even if we don't know for sure, I just think it's something where Obama should be talking about this, at least explaining, you know, why the U.S. is supporting this and what our goals are. I mean, I have really no idea what the goal is in this operation. I mean, it's funny. I think Smirk raised this on Twitter. It's actually a very smart point. We basically endorse a tactic, namely a no-fly zone, but not a strategy or an end state. And it's sort of a strange situation where we say, okay, you can fly planes and stop Libyans from killing their own people, but then what? Well, we have really no – we can't occupy the country, which was part of the UN resolution. So we have no real sense of what the next step in this process is. And so, for example, let's say that there's a ceasefire today, which would be great, of course, great for people in Benghazi. Okay, so do we still attack the Libyans, their military assets? Do we still hit their air bases and their air defenses? Do we accept a ceasefire in place with half the countries under Gaddafi, half the countries under the rebels? I mean, how's that process going to unfold? And what worries me a little bit about, it's funny, about the international system issue we raised before is, can the UN system survive a long-term sort of intervention in Libya? Can this coalition remain together around that? And you know, being in the White House at the time, all the problems that the administration had in keeping, you know, the NATO together around the coastal operation. It's a little worse than this one as well, especially when there's no clear end game that we want to accomplish here.
So I think the other side to that is that actually, in some ways, in some funny ways, the UN resolution sets out a clearer plan of action than the statements that have come out of Washington, in that the UN resolution is very clearly shaped around humanitarian goals. It sets up a special representative, and so it puts mechanism in place to negotiate a ceasefire and figure out what comes after that, and says, look, as long as you don't kill civilians, you know, if it's partition, it's partition. If it's whatever, it's whatever. And that, you know, in some respects, that's what the UN is there to do. So I do think, you know, obviously I think the Egyptians have a set of ideas if they're running guns over the border, which I gather they are. The Qataris clearly have a set of ideas because they despise Gaddafi for sort of historic reasons. I'm assuming that, well, actually, no, I don't want to over assume how much of an idea the French and the Brits have. But as I said, I think it's very easy when you're sitting where we're sitting to sort of ask a lot of really smart sounding questions about endgame and life. You know, it's funny, the two sets of critiques that we've all been leveling at the administration over the last couple of weeks are, number one, tell us the goal and the end state, and number two, why don't you get your act together faster? And that's the great joy of being outside, and it's also, you know, you need to do that. There's a value to that, but there's also a value to saying, look, this is happening very fast. Part of leadership when things are happening very fast is to make it up as best you can and to take the steps you have to take even when you can't know the end game or when your allies are running ahead of you. I mean, when your allies are running ahead of you anyway, and you've just got to shape it as best you can.
Yeah, I think this dithering charge to me is just ridiculous. I have to say, I mean, we took us how many months to get a coalition together to knock Saddam out of Kuwait? I mean, this is not something you do overnight. And you're dealing with very difficult allies with very difficult, very different interests. I think that the administration, you know, was a little surprised by this and had to figure out how to respond. And I think in some ways they've done a relatively good job of assembling a coalition here that basically leads them off the hook for the most part, we hope. So I think the dithering charge is kind of ridiculous, actually. And it's being made, I think, as you're right, by people who basically want to shoot first and ask questions later. I think the administration hasn't asked all those questions as much as they should as well, but, some of the criticism to me seems really unfair and sort of out of place with how quickly this thing has developed. I mean, a week or two ago, we were all saying, you know, Gaddafi's going to be out of power any day now. I don't think many of us expected things to be reversed this quickly. Militarily.
You know, that raises a political point that I think is worth making, which has been really interesting to me, and it'll be sort of fascinating to see where this goes next. That you had, you know, first you had the unusual spectacle of a bunch of neocons jumping up and down and saying, "Let's sick the International Criminal Court on Gaddafi."
Right.
Which, you know, it's one of those moments that you think to yourself,
the irony is rich.
Yes. Well, I just think, gosh, I must not have enough coffee yet. And then you had, you know, sort of George Will and Boehner and McConnell and Lugar going out and saying, well, actually, we approve of how the administration is handling this. We approve of the administration taking its time and thinking things through carefully and working with allies. And again, you think, you know, gosh, what did someone put in my drink? And then, you know, you look at the Republicans, but you have kind of some senior Republican leadership trying to reassert itself. And then you have the second tier of folks running for president in 2012 saying, no, wait, I want to get press coverage for trashing this. And a string of just truly insane things coming out of the mouths of the usual suspects. And you just think at a certain point, there has to be a penalty for this, because the public opinion polling in the states, people say, you know, we want to do something, but we don't want to be out in front of everybody else. We don't want to be unilaterally bombing an Arab country.
There's really no public support for this at all. I mean, I think what's most interesting to me is how Democrats went off the reservation to basically attack the administration. And Kerry doing an op-ed in the Washington Post saying, you know, fly zone, I felt crazy. I mean, I was very surprised with, you know, Anne Marie Slaughter saying what she said. This was a former administration official. You had a lot of folks on the Democratic side who were lacerating the administration on this. You had this, and so what you had was this really weird situation of this re-engagement of the old bipartisan coalition of liberal hawks and neocons, basically, that we saw around Bosnia, we saw obviously around Iraq, and we're seeing it again. And it's sort of amazing to see all the same people who got us to Iraq now coming out and saying we have to do something about Libya. I mean, it's really kind of shocking, actually, that, and how quickly we forget. You know, I mean, I caveat this by saying that I think you made a lot of good points here about why this is the right thing to do, how we can handle it well. But how quickly people in Washington said, not that we should respond, but that we should use military force, we should put a no-fly zone in effect.
No, I mean, I completely agree with you about the instant hop to the no-fly zone and the level that, at which the debate was conducted, including by a lot of people I really like and respect, was kind of disappointing. The thing that disappoints me going the other way, though, is that to me, and I think I'm stealing from Obama, that basically when the Arab League came and asked for something, that's a game changer. That if you believe in the international system, that's a game changer. And I thought there were a lot of people who, you know, including frankly yourself and some of what you've written, that that there should have been. You know, I don't expect this from neocons because I don't think they care that much about the international system. But from the left, you know, if we say we believe in international cooperation and, you know, the regional organization comes and asks you for something, you have to stop yelling, you know, war hawk, and at least sort of consider it seriously.
And I think also that the whole bit of the no-fly zone actually was really problematic, because what happened is that he basically went from 0 to 60 right away. It went from how do we respond to this? Let's send them the Air Force and you know, maybe the Marines. So instead of talking about, you know, possible things we could have done, recognizing rebels, sending humanitarian assistance, providing weapons, which we seem to be doing to neighboring countries, it went right to this debate about the no-fly zone. And it distorted the entire conversation and it basically became a political conversation. It became, are you strong enough? Is Obama, you know, too weak to respond, or is he dithering about this? And I think it unfortunately was interesting because I like from the left were the ones who were first making the no-fly zone argument. And I think in some ways it distorted this conversation to a place it shouldn't have gone to. And I would have preferred to see having a conversation about, you know, what do we want to get out of this? What are our interests? What are we trying to accomplish here? As opposed to, let's just adopt this tactic and hope for the best.
You know, I've been struggling with that also, Michael, over the last couple of weeks, because we keep writing, you know, at NSN, we keep writing pieces that say, let's talk about other things. And you just don't get any traction for that at all. And I think it's really worth pointing out what that says about how broken our government is and our public debate is, that we can't conceptualize anything except the use of military force. We don't have the habits of thought. We don't have the vocabulary. I mean, even among, you know, sort of sophisticated people just don't have any of that in their vocabulary anymore because of what we've done to ourselves in the post 9/11 era. And I'm actually just thinking about it with you now that's why this debate emerged in the kind of silly, misshapen way that it did.
Yeah, this is my biggest issue, actually. It's almost more metaphoric than anything else. That, you know, Monday is the 8th anniversary of the Iraq War, which is like the signal lesson in why you should not just intervene unilaterally, or you should be very restrained in the use of military force. And it, with that, and we still have 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, obviously, which is a whole other conversation. And yet, with all of that, all the knowledge we have how disastrous these interventions have been, we just, as you suggest, just immediately jump to the notion that we need to send the military in response to this. And I think it is to suggest a lack of sort of maturity almost in our policy debate.
Yes.
That we seem unable to think of, you know, diplomatic solutions, political, economic solutions. That the first thought is to shoot, and not just that, but like, you know, not shooting, showing restraint, not using military force is somehow seen as a character flaw, as if it's a sign of weakness that is irredeemable. I think that's the problem that I have a little bit, is that we seem to not have been able to get past the mistakes that we've made over the past several years in the use of our military force. And immediately, your knee-jerk jump to think, okay, this is how we're going to respond to this. I think that's the bigger issue, and I don't know what the solution is for that.
So
especially because
small,
now the administration is endorsing
it. I want to make a small contribution to the solution to that, since it seems to be my role to be the in-house Pollyanna this morning.
Okay.
And I want to say something positive about something that has gotten absolutely zero attention that is non-military, but that there is an incredible humanitarian operation going on both on the Tunisian and the Egyptian borders. And, you know, so the things to think about are, first of all, how much the government change in those two countries has made that possible, how much those governments have gone out of their way to really be helpful and open and welcoming to both Libyan and third country nationals coming across the borders, and how just that's a, in many ways, it's a positive paradigm of what how you want countries to behave in a crisis. And second, that there's been, you know, an enormous international response, and the State Department official in charge of refugees, Eric Schwartz, was out there just last week, and I was reading, you know, his press conference afterwards, and where he talked about what they're doing, and nobody's writing about that, nobody's talking about it, but that's the other piece of this that has to come together, and that is coming together, and that, you know, frankly, NGOs and the U.S. government and the neighboring countries and the U.N. are all doing exactly what you would want them to do, and it's quite, given that, you know, it's a lot of poor folks from, you know, folks from Egypt who are stuck in the West and can't get back to Egypt, folks from South Asia, and it's just extraordinary, and it's a really good thing that's happening, and it's a way that people who look at a bad situation and want to help could feel proud of what the international system is doing with their tax dollars and their donations, you know, very much as we look at the situation in Japan. But we're not talking about it at all. Nobody knows that's happening.
I think the other thing too, and to be a little Pollyannish, or maybe a little sort of forward thinking here a little bit, is that, you know, if this is successful and it sort of enshrines the notion of rights to protect as a legitimate international sort of dictate or international norm, I should say, how then do you make R2P a more effective tool of the international system? I mean, do you create some sort of rapid response, you know, force that can go and put into place when these kind of things happen? I mean, I think that's where, if there's where something positive can come out of this, if R2P can become something that is actually has broader international support, and you have the tools in place to be able to activate it as quickly as possible when these kind of things happen, I think that's something that's very good that can come out of this. It's a shame we didn't have it beforehand. I mean, I understand why, but it's something that I think can be built upon if there is success here with Libya. I mean, I got to come back, and this is why all my hesitation about this is tempered by the fact that what we talked about earlier in the conversation, that really the UN system has stepped up in a way that I think you and I probably wouldn't have imagined possible. And that is something I think liberal nationalists like us have dreamed about for 20 years, to think the UN could be this forum or this force for not only for good, but certainly for pushing for security solutions to serious, intractable humanitarian problems. And we may actually have the system in place. We may have some consensus in the world for that. And if we can sort of build on that, it seems to me the most positive thing about this entire experience.
Michael, I'm feeling like maybe we should end it there while you're waxing all optimistic. And I'm starting to feel incredibly anxious, because I know there's just, for all the reasons that you laid out, that there isn't the consensus to have military forces available in advance, or, you know, do any of what you said. There's a million reasons why this may end up not being, you know, nearly enough to actually solve the problem on the ground. But while we're on an optimistic note, say thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for a great conversation.
I was going to say one last thing, which is that I just think what's worth, I mean, this is a close call. I think this conversation shows really how close a call this is as to supporting or not supporting it. And I think, you know, we both feel like, I think we're both on that line of like 50-50 where we come down on this. And I think we're, you know, that's probably a good consensus point among other progressives.
Okay, well, Blogging Heads folks, you saw it here first. I keep my job for another week. Great talking to you, Michael.